morning. And welcome to this first talk on the last day of Tech Days, unless you're coming back in the weekend. So in this 75-minute session, we will be discussing some features that are added to Silverlight 5. And we're focusing on the line of business features. So I won't be talking about media players or playback rates or something. We're going to focus on the line of business part of things and see what is new in that area in Silverlight 5. So my name is Gilles Kleren. I'm coming from Belgium. I think it's the fifth year or something that I'm here at Tech Days in the Netherlands. I work for Ordina in Belgium, which is a Dutch company. Any colleagues of mine here? Thank you, colleagues. None. Okay. So I'm a regional director and a Silverlight MVP. So I'm doing quite a lot of XAML, focusing heavily on focused on WPF, coming from ASP.NET, then moved to Silverlight, Windows Phone. And I'm focusing a lot on Windows 8 development. I'm doing a talk on Windows 8 development for Silverlight developers, I think, session after lunch, which is actually going to explain how you can transition your Silverlight knowledge into Windows 8, which might be interesting for you as well. I've written two books, actually, on Silverlight. The first one is out for about 2 years, and the next one is going to be released in a couple of weeks. It's going to be focused. It's going to be called Silverlight 5 Data and Services Cookbook. It should be out 2-3 weeks from now. You can see my blog as well as my email and my Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter. Send me a mail afterwards if you have any questions on Silverlight or XAML development in general. I'll post all the demos of this talk on my blog as well, so you can download them from there. By the way, I have a cold. Maybe you've already seen or heard it, so I apologize if I start sneezing along the way, so my apologies up front. So I have actually divided this talk in four parts. The first one is going to be about the data binding novelties in Silverlight 5. There's actually quite a few new things in the data binding area in Silverlight 5. And data binding is, granted, probably the most important feature in line of business development with Silverlight. So we're going to start with that. I think that will take about 30 minutes or so. Then we'll take a look at the novelties in the application model department. So how can Silverlight applications run? Can they run in-browser, out-of-browser, and those kinds of things, and what permissions can they have? Then we'll take a look at controls. There's a few new things in the controls area. That's a very small part. And I will finish off by looking at some miscellaneous stuff, things that don't really fit into any other of the parts. So at the end of the talk, I hope you'll get a deeper understanding of what is new in Silverlight 5 when you're building line-of-business applications. If you have any questions, feel free to shout, and I'll try to solve them as good and as possible. Okay. So as mentioned, we'll start with the data binding part. I assume everyone is familiar with Silverlight. I also assume that you're familiar with topics like data binding. I won't be explaining what data binding is, but I'm going to focus, of course, on what is new. So what is new in data binding was actually quite a few interesting things that were added to data binding in Silverlight 5. The first is data binding debugging, which is actually quite interesting. I will start with that. There's not really that much to show about it, but I'm going to talk about it and show you how it works. Then we'll take a look at the ancestor relative source binding, the implicit data template. Style binding is new as well, allowing us to bind styles, or perform data binding within style expressions. We'll take a look at custom markup extensions at the iCustom type provider, and we'll finish off with data context changed event. So those are the things that were added in Silverlight 5 in the data binding area. So as mentioned, we'll start with data binding debugging. Data binding, if you've worked with Silverlight, you'll probably know that data binding is a very powerful feature. But it is sometimes hard to find errors in data binding statements. The IntelliSense is not always providing you with the correct options. And if you type anything wrong there, it's very hard to find what goes wrong. Sometimes you get an output in your output window in Visual Studio, you get some output about the data binding failing. It depends on the binding that you're doing, if that information is going to be useful or not. If you're using it in combination with MVVM, it's sometimes even with that output in the output window hard to figure out what is going wrong. So it is a very forgiving piece of software, but it's, on the other hand, therefore sometimes difficult to find errors that you may have made. And with Silverlight 5, it's actually possible to put breakpoints inside of your XAML code on lines that contain a data binding statement. So other lines, of course, you can't break on them, but lines that have a data binding statement in them will actually be possible to put a breakpoint there. And when you do that, you can actually see what the binding is doing and why it is failing, if there are any errors, and so on and so forth. So there's not really much to tell about it. So I'm going to switch to the demos immediately. So maybe I should move it a bit like this. Okay, so this is a regular Silverlight application that has a couple of data binding statements in them. So let's scroll down. So here it is, on this line, you see that I've put a breakpoint here. And I can do that because there is a data binding statement in that line. Other lines don't accept me putting any breakpoints in there. So when I run it, this is actually on the main page, so that breakpoint is going to be hit immediately. So I can now take a look at the locals window. And within that locals window, I have the binding state, which is actually containing all the information about that data binding, including what is going wrong. In this case, there is nothing actually wrong, so the error is null. But I can also, for example, take a look at the object I'm binding to through the final source, which is actually the source of the binding. So I can take a look at the object that I'm binding to, including all its properties and their values, as you can see here. So this is actually of type SilverlightBanking.owner. You can also take a look at the binding, which is actually the binding object that I'm using. So as you can see here, the values for the fallback value, string format, and target null value that I'm adding to the binding object will also be shown. So everything that has to do with the binding is shown, including errors and validation errors. If you've made any errors in your validation, you'll probably also notice them in this locals window. So this is a really handy feature that works in Silverlight 5, but when you install the Silverlight 5 tools and you're working on a Silverlight 4 project, it will also work in Visual Studio 2010. So that will also be possible to debug Silverlight 4 projects with the Silverlight 5 tools installed. Okay. Let's now take a look at a new type of binding, which is the ancestor relative source binding. Ancestor relative source binding has been in WPF, I think, since the first version, but it hadn't made the cut into Silverlight 5, and they changed that, of course, with this new version. Now, the ancestor relative source binding has some specific scenarios, and I'm going to explain how you can use it using one of these scenarios. Assume that you're binding to a list box, and for the items in the list box, you use a data template, which is often something that you do to make the UI a bit better. And when you do that, the data source or the data context for each of the outputted data templates is the item that you're binding to. So you have a list of persons, say five persons. The data template is emitted five times, and each of the data templates is binding to one of those persons in the list. That's how the binding actually works in combination with a data template. It's therefore not possible with a regular binding from within that data template to bind to a property not on that object. So you cannot go outside of the template. It's not possible out of the box. So that is something that you can do with an ancestor relative source binding. With the ancestor relative source binding from within that data template, you can say, well, I want to bind to some other parent in my XAML tree. You can actually get out of, of the data template and bind to a property which is somewhere relative to where we are in that position. So most of the applications where you use this is in combination with a data template. There's two ways of using this. You can set the ancestor level to a number of steps you want to walk up the XAML tree. And then there is another one, which is the ancestor type, which is saying, well, from within my data template, walk up the XAML tree, and when you find that specific type of control, that's what I want you to bind to. That is going to be the ancestor that I want you to bind to. May still be a bit unclear. Let's go and take a look at it in a demo. So I'm going to this list box demo, All right. It seems I'm not the only one who's sick here. Lots of people are sick here. I didn't catch that. This machine is making so much noise over here. Maybe I'm overheating it by putting something on top. Okay, so let's run this thing first. So this is actually done using the ancestor relative source and is in fact in SilverLight 4 not possible unless you use an item container style, which is actually going around quite a bit for something very simple. So what I want to achieve here is that when I click on one of the items inside of the list box, I actually show that green rectangle. So I'm actually binding the visibility of that rectangle, which is inside of the data template, to the isselected property of my item in the list box, of my list box item. That's what I'm trying to achieve here. That is by default not possible without an ancestor relative source binding. I'm going to leave it open because there's a second timer in here. So let's take a look at the code. So we have this list box here, this one. And inside of that list box, I have an item template called list box item template. And that is somewhere here at the top. So that is a regular data template that I'm using to visualize each of the items. And notice the visibility of that rectangle over here. So that is that green rectangle that you saw. And I'm binding the visibility. I want to bind that to the isselected property of its parent, being the list box item. So I'm binding using a relative source binding, and I say to that binding, well, your ancestor type is a list box item. So from within the data template, walk up the XAML tree until you find an instance of a list box item. It can be the first parent, it can be higher up in the tree, all that is possible. Now that is, of course, a Boolean. So I'm binding to the isselected property, which is of type Boolean. So I need to include a converter, which is in this case simply converting a Boolean to a system Windows visibility enumeration value. That's what I'm doing here. Huh? You got that? So, in fact, I'm actually saying to my listbox item, to binding inside of my listbox item, walk up the XAML tree. Now, there are some specific other uses of this as well. I needed this one. Assume in an MVVM scenario that I want to bind inside of a data template to a property which is exposed on the view model. So a practical application of that is this. This is also a list box. And on that, in the data template of that list box, I want to bind this combo box to a property which is exposed on my view model. So that property is directly on the view model. I can't do that without an ancestor relative source binding. Let me show you how I'm doing that. So in the code behind, which I'm using as view model here, by specifying this.dataContext equals this, which is more or less, it's not correct in MVVM terms, but it's okay for now. And I actually want to bind that comma box to this user's property, to that user's observable collection. I can't do that without an ancestor relative source from within a data template. Let's take a look. So here we have that list box, and it has an item template called combo box item template. And that is somewhere over here. So I want to bind the combo box to that user's property. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set the item source. I'm going to say the binding is, or the source of the binding, is relative source, ancestor type is user control. So I'm going to say walk up the XAML tree until you find that user control, and then bind to data context dot users, which is that user's property on my view model. Okay, so there's quite a few interesting things that you can do with that ancestor relative source binding, including making scenarios possible that were difficult to do in MVVM without it. Okay, let's take a look at the implicit data template. We already had, since SilverLight 4, the implicit style. An implicit style was basically a style without a key. So basically saying I'm defining a target type in my style declaration, but I'm not adding a key, which is therefore going to become the default style for that particular target type. So every control of that target type is going to take on that style. Now the same thing is added, something similar is added in SilverLight 5, but now for templates. We can now define a template for a type, so that whenever SilverLight encounters an instance of that type that needs to be visualized, it will actually take on that implicit data template. So you simply specify a data template. You don't associate it with a user control, with the control type, like a target, using the target type. You're actually going to say, well, this type, for example, the person, needs to be visualized using this particular data template. That allows you to do scenarios that were previously also not possible with SilverLight. For example, you can bind, I think it's on the next slide, yeah. You can create an implicit data template for a base class, like person, and if you have inheriting types on that person type, like manager and employee, for each of these types, you create a new implicit data template. Automatically, SilverLight will look at the types if you bind it to a collection of persons in that case. It will automatically pick the correct data template. This makes it possible within one items control, like a list box, to have more than one visualization within the same list box, which is, again, something that is not possible otherwise. The data template selector that is available in WPF is not available in SilverLight, but this implicit data template more or less allows you to do something similar like a data template selector. Not the real thing, but it's more or less possible to have within one items control the same, different data templates. This is something that is, of course, most of the time used in combination with either an items control or a content presenter. Okay. Let's take a look at that implicit data templates. That is over here. Oops, this one. So we're going to run it first. If the machine is working along, there we go. There we go. I think the machine is still a bit asleep for some reason. Okay. So we have a simple list box here, which is visualizing person instances using a data template. You can see that it's a data template because each item is represented by a grid with three rows and two columns. Okay, what I'm going to do is let's take a look first at the main page, which has a list box. And you would assume that there is an item template property specified on this list box. Well, let's take a look. So you can see there is no item template defined on this list box. However, in the AppSAML, there is a data template specified. It doesn't have a target type, but it has a data type. So that means that whenever I need to visualize that type, SilverLight is going to default to this visual representation. So when I ask SilverLight in this case to visualize a observable collection of person instances, and I'm binding that using an item source in this case. Whenever I'm doing that, I'm basically asking, I'm saying to SilverLight, visualize it. Normally it would use the two-string implementation, but now it notices that it has a data template associated with that type, so it will automatically default to this type and to this data template and use that for the visualization. What you can also do, for example, is I can click on one of these persons and I can say show that person in detail. I'm using another feature that we'll look at later on, which is creating new windows. But what I'm doing here is I'm instantiating that new window and I'm binding that to the selected item inside of that list box. I'm doing that through, let's take a look at the code. So I'm asking SilverLight, what is the selected person? Creating a new window. We'll take a look at that later on. And I set the window content to to a user control, which is called person window. And I specify the data context to be that selected person. Inside of this user control, I use a content presenter. And that content presenter, its content property is set to binding. So I'm actually specifying the entire person to to be the data context for this for this user control. Silverlight automatically will pick up again on that data template, and it will automatically use it to visualize that person instance. So you can use it in combination with items controls like list boxes, or also in combination with the content presenter. It's basically a default representation of a type, so that Silverlight won't be using the toString, but it will be using this type data template for your visualization. Yes?
Did you have manager and employees?
Yes.
Yeah. They could be
displayed as different. Yeah, so, yeah. So, indeed. So, the question was if we have a manager and an employee and something else displayed in the same list, so a polymorphism, that's what you're asking. Will Silverlight pick up on the correct data template if we have defined several data templates? Yes, it will do that. So that allows you to mix actually several data templates within the same list. Yeah, that's possible, which is otherwise not possible in Silverlight. Okay? All right. Let's take a look at the next feature, which is style binding. The style binding is, like the word says, the option to do data binding from within a style, which is also something that was previously not possible. A style was fixed, it had some fixed values, and boom, case closed. And in Silverlight, Silverlight 5, it becomes possible now to do bindings from within a style setter. You can actually do a data binding from within the setter of a style to an object. This opens up some interesting scenarios, so that you can, for example, make like a theming object, an object that contains values that you're going to bind to, and you can let those values change, and automatically the style will update it as well, which will then make it possible to create like a dynamic theming object. This is how it works. You create some object, let's call that the theming object, and we're going to create a style, and within the values of the setters of that style, we're going to bind to properties on that object, on that theming object. And several views are going to use that style. When the object changes, it has to implement, of course, the iNotify property changed. The style is going to be notified about that change of values, and automatically the views that use that style will be updated as well. So this enables you to create like a dynamic object and a dynamic styling object, theming object, to change the values of a style throughout the run of the application. Close this one down and open a new one, style binding. Okay. So we have this object called color setter. There we go. And it implements the iNotify property change interface. That is, of course, required. Oops, come on. And there's two properties, two fields on that one, brush 1 and brush 2, that I'm going to use. And initially, I set them to, I have a Boolean value called red, and I set that to false. Initially, things should be orange and red, and otherwise they're going to be white and black. Let's take a look first at how you can see this, how this can be visualized. So I have an interface. There we go. First it's black and white. Now it's becoming red and orange. Black and white again. Orange and red again. That's those two values that you see here in this change colors method. So I'm changing the values of two properties, brush 1 and brush 2. Those properties are exposed, as you can see here, solid color brush and brush 1 and brush 2, and they do a race property change of the brush 1 and brush 2 as well. That is my theming object. In my style, which is defined inside of my application, .xaml file, I have several setters, and one of these setters of each of these styles is bound to one of the properties on that theming object, so brush 1 and brush 2. Yeah. You see here that this one is getting its values through a binding. This one is binding to brush 1 and this one is binding to brush 2. Of which object? Well, of an object that I instantiated of the type color setter. That's this one. I'm binding that to I've studied that as the source for my binding. My main page basically doesn't do anything different. It uses a style like it would normally use a style. This one is binding to default style text block, which is one of these two, default style text block and title style text block. Nothing particular special going on. In the code behind, I'm getting that object that I used as my source for my style bindings, my theming object. So I'm asking the resources of my application, get me that local color setter, cast it to a color setter, and then call on to that change colors method, which is going to change the values of these two properties, which is then going to raise a property changed, which is going to notify Silverlight, well, that style value has changed, and automatically all the views that are using that style will be updated as well. This enables scenarios where you want to dynamically alter the style throughout the run of the application. Okay. Yes. Sorry, can you repeat? This machine is making so much noise.
So this is an explicit style, you say my control has this style.
Yes.
Implicit style?
Yes, it works on implicit styles as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question. So the question was, does it work on implicit styles as well? And it works on every type of style. Yeah. It's built into styling mechanism, so it works on implicit and explicit styles. Okay. So next thing that we'll look at is markup extensions and custom markup extensions. So a markup extension, to people who don't really know what a markup extension is or how it works, it's basically a way to let the data, the Silverlight parser be notified about something that it cannot handle. So what happens when your Silverlight code is being executed? It runs through the XAML, the Silverlight parser, or the XAML parser, runs through your XAML, and at some point it notices a markup extension that you know by the curly braces. And basically that is a sign for the XAML parser to say, well, I can't handle this. The XAML parser is doing one thing, it's creating visual objects. But at some point it notices that it needs to create a binding, so it has to call on to .NET to ask .NET, well, can you create for me that binding object? So when a markup extension is executing, it's basically the XAML parser asking .NET to create an object that is attached to one of the items in the visual tree, but it's not part of the visual tree. So a binding object is attached to, say, a text block, but it's not part of the visual tree, which is quite normal. With Silverlight, up until Silverlight 5, only a few markup extensions exist, the binding and the static resource, which is basically the Silverlight, or the XAML parser, asking, create me a binding object and do this and that with it. That's what a markup extension normally does. Now, in Silverlight 5, it has become possible to create markup extensions yourself. You can create your own markup extensions, which was previously not possible. Now, if you think back what I just said, the markup extension is basically a way for the XAML parser to ask .NET to do something. And that's what a custom markup extension will also do. It's a way of calling onto code that needs to be executed, initiated by your XAML parser. It's a way of triggering the execution of code from within XAML. It already existed in WPF, but it's now only added in Silverlight 5 with Silverlight 5. There are some there's a lot of places where you can use this. Things like calling onto the instantiation of static classes from XAML, which is not possible otherwise. Places where you would normally use a converter, you can perhaps do it with a custom markup extension to make your code a bit nicer and cleaner. Things like automatic translations, I'm going to show that in just a second. So, let's take a look at these custom markup extensions. I'm going to start by running the demo, but it's visually a very unattractive demo. I'm going to do it anyhow. Come on. So what you notice when it's on the screen, there we go, is that we see some text on the screen being displayed. It's very small, but it doesn't matter what it really says. You see that there is some values being shown, and that's about it. Those texts are there through custom markup extensions. We'll leave it open so we can come back to it. Oops. So let's take a look at that main page. So the first one here was saying, you, sir, are great, you created a custom markup extension. Now, how did that text come there? Well, we have a text block for which the text is getting its value from something called local simple extension. By the way, Silverlight does show some squiggly lines of Visual Studio. It does some squiggly lines every now and then. It doesn't matter. It actually works. So we're asking it to instantiate that simple extension class. Simple extension is located over here. And it is a markup extension. You can notice that it's a markup extension because it inherits from markup extension. And we have to overwrite the provide value method. The provide value method returns an object, so you can return whatever you want. In this case, the result is going to be shown in the text property of a text block. So I need to return a text. But if I'm binding to, let's say, a brush, we can easily return a brush here. So we can return whatever you want. If you want to, come on, there we go, to pass some parameters, like the binding, this has a mode, it's two-way, and stuff like that. In this case, I'm saying person extension, I need to pass you some parameters. These parameters are just plain public properties on an extension, as you can see here. Of course, in a real-life scenario, I would have to check in my provide value if those values, if those properties have a value. In this case, it's just a demo. Now, in the slide, it says a useful scenario, a practical scenario, can, for example, be translations. I'm coming from Belgium, so we don't quite know which language that we have to use. So most applications need to be at least bilingual. So this is, for some Belgian companies, something that we often come across. Now, why is this interesting to do localizations of your application? Assume that you don't want to use resources because your translations are perhaps in a database. One of the scenarios could be, well, I arrive on my Silverlight application and I know what the language needs to be. Perhaps I ask the current thread what language does it need to be. And initially I ask a service, give me all the translations for the entire application. I download them, perhaps store them in isolated storage. And then through a custom markup extension, like I'm using here, I write a markup extension that talks to some service API, not a real service API, but a utility class, that returns the value in the correct language that I'm using. This keeps my XAML very clean, and it abstracts away the translation mechanism for my application. Let me show you. So in the markup extension translator extension, in the provide value, I simply get through a custom class translator service the correct translation. In the background, this has downloaded me the correct translations for my application, and therefore I can keep my XAML very clean, not cluttering it with resource key stuff and all that kinds of rubbish. This makes a very clean way of creating a multi-language application. And last thing here is binding validation extension. That binding validation extension is not inheriting from markup extension. However, it's inheriting from binding. Now, binding inherits from binding base, and that in turn is also a markup extension. So what am I doing here? I'm creating a custom type of binding. Instead of always, if you have a lot of bindings throughout your applications, instead of always writing the mode is two-way, validates or notify data errors is true, and notify and validation errors is true, inside of my XAML, I make that my default binding. So I set them to a specific value inside of the constructor that I, for example, can use then for text boxes, I'm sorry. Making, again, my XAML code a bit cleaner. So in general, using a custom markup extension is a way to, well, trigger the execution of code and actually go very far with it. Yes? Okay. This one is a very specific one, which is something that I personally have never used, but it's a bit of a difficult one. Since Silverlight, up until Silverlight 5, it was not possible to bind to an object that had dynamic properties. We cannot add in Silverlight properties to an object and then perform bindings on it. At compile time, Silverlight needs to know what it's binding to, otherwise it won't work. Now in Silverlight 5, it has become possible to use the iCustomTypeProvider interface. If you are binding to an object that implements this interface, Silverlight will allow you to bind to properties which are only added at runtime and are not therefore available at compile time. There's not that many places where you can really use this. You can do it if you have a service that doesn't always return the same fields, and you want to instantiate types on the fly, and you want to bind to that, then you have to use this iCustomTypeProvider interface. It's a very simple interface, as you can see here. It has just one method called getCustomType. So what is actually done in Silverlight 5, they changed the data binding engine so that the data binding engine will check if the type that you're binding to is implementing this iCustomTypeProvider. If it's not, well, then it continues just like it would do in Silverlight 4. Otherwise, it asks this getCustomType to give back it an instance of that, or to give back the type object of the custom type you're binding to, so it can perform its bindings. This may sound a bit abstract. Let's take a look at it in a demo. This is I'm using a helper class which you can download from MSDN. So in case you want to use this, I suggest you take a look at that class. It's also included in the download, so you can take a look at it from there as well. So this custom class easily allows you to do things like an add property. Let me run it first. So I'm going to load data. There we go. And if I'm binding here, I have a grid that I'm binding, a data grid that I'm binding on the description is playing, and the director, the duration, and the title of movies. So something very simple, you may think. Well, yeah, it's actually quite simple, but now we have to wait a couple of seconds. I made the mistake of touching the toolbox. Here we go. And that's not very responsive for some reason. Okay, so let's open it in Notepad already. And not this one. So we have this helper class. Open that with Notepad. So this helper class implements the iCustomTypeProvider. And I, as mentioned, advise you to download this one. It, of course, has the get type somewhere. It's not that easy to find things. I'm finding all the get types that I don't have to find. Is Visual Studio ready? Okay, it's ready. That's easier. So it has this get custom type. I was searching for get type, I'm sorry. So that's what you see here. It implements this get custom type, and it also implements some utility methods like add property. My movie object, remember in the UI we had title, duration, description, director, and is playing. Yeah, those values, those properties are not on this type. They are added dynamically. So in Silverlight 4, you would not be able to bind to this movie type. In Silverlight 5, I simply let my type inherit from my custom type helper, that helper class in movie. So in my code that is binding up this or that creating up that data grid, I'm adding first two properties, the isPlaying and the director. Then I instantiate some movie instances where I also give a value to the isPlaying and the director. And from there on, I can simply data mine. As you can see somewhere, I'm specifying that my data grid should be bound to an item source to that observable collection of movies. However, Movies is a dynamic type. It adds new properties on the fly. Okay. And the final thing, before we move on to some other topic, is the data context changed event. As the word says, the data context changed is an event that is triggered when the data context is changing. There are also some very specific scenarios for this one. One of them being when you bind to events being raised from the target of your data binding for other events, and you want to switch the data context, you need to be notified about the data context being changed on the fly, which is something that otherwise you have to do manually. Now you can do that through the data binding engine. Let me run this example. So you see here that the weather is changing in Brussels quite often. And so this is my data. So there is an object behind it. That is the data context. And now I'm going to change the city. And I'm actually going to bind my the generation of lines of text in that list box whenever the values are changing. Now, if I would not be notified about the data context changing, one of these two objects that is not currently the data context would keep on triggering those events, and my list box would keep on growing at double speed, which I don't want. I want to be notified about the data context changing along the way. And then I can do using my data context changed event. So in this code behind, I have here two city weather instances, weather in Brussels and weather in London. I initially set the data context to weather in Brussels, and then I specify the data context changed, which is then handled by this data context changed event. Now first, as mentioned, when I click on the button, I change my data context, and I want to be notified about that thing changing. When it is changing, this data context changed event is going to be raised. I get in the old data context. And that's what I was referring to earlier. I want to unbind for events, like in this case the city weather property changed, on that old city weather, because that is what is triggering the generation of all those lines in that list box. So I want to unbind from that. I want to bind for the new one. So I'm changing the values, and I also want to be notified only of the current data context events. There are some cases where you need this. This is not something that you'll need every day, but there are cases where this can come in handy. Okay. Let's now take a look at the application model. So the application model is how can civilized applications run in browser, out of browser, with elevated trust, and so on and so forth. Now in Silverlight 5, some new application modes have been added. Some new stuff in that area has been added. And also, Silverlight applications that run out of browser have some new abilities, like unrestricted file access, full keyboard access in full screen modes, in browser mode. But let's take a look at them in more detail. So with Silverlight 4, the biggest change probably was the addition or the possibility to be able to run Silverlight applications out of browser with elevated permissions, which allowed Silverlight applications to do a lot more on the system than was previously possible, like interacting with the file system, call on COM components, and so on and so forth. Now, in Silverlight 5, starting with Silverlight 5, it is now also possible to have applications in browser with elevated permissions. Now, that is not, it doesn't work in the exact same way like in Silverlight 4, out-of-browser applications. So out-of-browser applications ask the user, can we run with elevated permissions? Silverlight 5 applications that run in browser with elevated permissions or as trusted applications need to have this set via group policy. So it's not something that you can just say, let's run it in the browser with elevated permissions. It only works if the administrator has set that in the group policy of your company. So this is something that you'll typically use within intranet applications, not with on internet applications, because basically not possible. No application running on the internet would be able to run that. Unless it's set in your group policy, but it's more of the time it's going to be a thing that's useful within intranet applications. So if you place the different modes next to each other, we have sandboxed, which is regular outer browser, Silverlight 4 trusted, and Silverlight 5 trusted. So prompt tree is basically saying, well, when you do copy, for example, or when you use the webcam, is this going to be, is the user okay with it, that prompt? Still appears in sandboxed, doesn't appear in Silverlight 4 and Silverlight 5 trusted applications. The same goes for cross-domain networking. Silverlight will not do a cross-domain check if you're running trusted, not in Silverlight 4, not in Silverlight 5. Full screen keyboard access is added in Silverlight 4 trusted apps, of course still works in Silverlight 5. And then COM interaction was added with Silverlight 4 trusted applications. It's not possible with a regular out-of-browser application. In Silverlight 5, basically, some new things have been added. It's now possible to do unrestricted file access, which we'll take a look at in just a second. P-invoke is possible, and the ability to run it inside of the browser has also been added. Okay. So when you want to run a Silverlight application with elevated trust inside of the browser, it's simply through configuration that you can do that. As you can see there, there is a new checkbox, and it results in the generation of a new in-browser settings XML file, which basically says, well, this application can run with elevated permissions. It's the same thing as for an out-of-browser application that runs with elevated permissions. It also needs to be signed, and you can do that via Visual Studio or command line. But who does that via command line? Okay, let's take a look at this in a demo. Can't really show you a lot because it just works. It works from the local host, so local host apps can run with elevated permissions. Otherwise, you have to start changing registry settings, which I haven't done on this machine. So we'll do it from a local host. So let's try to run this thing. Let's first take a look at the properties of the project. So there is now a new checkbox here, require elevated trust when running in browser. So let's run this. And the application will check if it has elevated permissions. It runs in browser, and there you go, it says I'm elevated. I could have put that text up there and not show you the code, but anyway, I'm not going to do that. You need to trust me. So what I'm doing here is I'm saying, is the application that is currently running, does it have elevated permissions? And if it has, then show that textbook, I'm an elevated application. Yeah? So it has elevated trust, just like a Silverlight 4 application could have elevated permissions.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, sure.
For smaller companies, they don't use group policy settings.
Yeah.
Would it be possible to somehow...
No, it's not. Yeah, you can do it via a registry setting, but that's. I don't think that's really aimed at using it. It's more like testing stuff. But you could perhaps do that, but I wouldn't suggest on doing it. So the question was, if you don't use group policy, can we then still do this? Yeah, there is, like I mentioned, a registry key that you can set, in which you can allow specific domains to run this type of elevated permissions applications in browser. It's possible, but in my opinion, it's more like a developer setting that you can use. So I would be careful with doing that. Now, one of the things that becomes possible through this is do full screen keyboard access in browser, which is not otherwise possible. Silverlight out-of-browser applications with elevated permissions can, of course, run in full screen. But in-browser applications that don't have elevated trust can't do that. You can't do typing in full screen mode. This can be a limitation if you want to build a kiosk application. So let's try this thing. So I'm going to run an application with elevated permissions inside of the browser, of course. and try to run it in full screen. So let's run this thing. Notice that when we go full screen, there's no pop-up saying, "Well, click or hit localhost to go back to go back out of full screen." So I can type here. There we go. I can switch to full screen. Notice no browser message, or plugin message basically, and I can still type. Escape doesn't work, so do provide something that the user can still get out of this thing. Yeah? So don't forget this type of button that switches you back out of full screen, unless you want to annoy your user, which sometimes we all do. Okay, so basically this still works. This just works. Yes, question. Wait, I need to come closer. 1 second. We're coming to that in just a second. So the question was, can we run HTML in browser? Well, let me just change some slides for you. There we go. Okay. So the question was, can we run HTML in browser? Yes, we can. So it is now possible to use that web browser control that we got in Silverlight 4 to run that inside of the browser. It's perfectly possible. So we can do an in-browser, web browser in Silverlight 4, should you have any need for that. The question probably came from someone who wants to integrate Silverlight with an existing ASP application or whatever application. And that's a perfect legit scenario. If you want to build a closer integration, you can do that. Let's take a look at this thing. This one. So we have the browser in the browser demo. And I should have internet available so we can test it. So I'm going to go with a web browser to bing.com. So there we go. Go to bing.com. Bing.com should be loading. There we go. So this is a Silverlight application, and this is now Bing running. Yeah, this is not something that you want to do for public sites. No, that's not possible. The question was, can you do this for a public site? Well, no, that's not possible. That is not the scenario that they have actually made possible. But do think of the fact that this is now running as an application with elevated trust. It can access the Windows directory. It can start deleting files if you want to. So, and it doesn't ask the user any permission to do so. So that's not something that you'll want to, that most users will like if you're doing that. One thing that we can test is what happens if we direct that browser control to itself. Now, apparently, someone at Microsoft thought of this, and actually, after rendering itself 10 times, which is what it's doing now, it's actually going to itself 10 times, it basically locks up itself. So, because otherwise, we would be able to create a browser in a browser in a browser and go deeper and deeper. If you've seen the film Inception, that's basically what you're doing then. That's what this guy is doing here.
But you can set this dynamically. So
and then you get this.
If you use an external reporting tool that runs in an iframe, you could dynamically set it to server within your environment based on setting.
So that's what happens when you go too deep inside of Windows. Okay, so another thing that is now possible is accessing every file in the file system. You can do that. Previously in Silverlight 4, trusted apps, and this goes for in and out of browser, you could access only the My Documents, the My Pictures, the My Movies, and the My... what did I forget? One of these My folders. Silverlight 5 can basically access anything on the machine. So it has unrestricted file access. That means that I can close this one down. That I can, for example, browse the Windows directory. Unrestricted file access, this one. So I am going to loop through my Windows directory and load all the directories that I can find there. I'm not going to delete them, which might not be good through my demo. But I'm basically looping over the Windows directory, reading out all the directories that are in there. And we do that, it just works with some regular I.O. code and directory, enumerate directories in the Windows directory. This just works. I could have deleted some files. My serverless application has permission on doing that. Okay. Let's move on and take a look at some novelties around controls. I'm going to show you the rich text block over control, the pivot viewer control, which is not new but has had some changes, the combo box type ahead, and double clicking. This is actually going to go very fast. So the text block overflow control, or the text overflow in general, is something that is added in Silverlight 5 to allow you to create richer layout of text. So previously you simply had the rich text box, which you could set to enabled or not to allow controls and stuff to run inside of it. Now in Silverlight 5, you have the rich text block and the rich text block overflow control. What you do is you place a lot of text inside of the rich text block, and whenever that rich text block is full, it will automatically flow over to one or more overflow controls. This allows you to create like a chain. The first one says, when I'm full, go to this one. That one says, when I'm full, go to this one, and so on and so forth. So you can create a magazine-like looking layout with this with these controls. You can see that it's actually an overflow control when you do a selection. And you can actually drag over them, and it will trigger them all. Or you can drag over all the textbook overflow controls, and you can select the text in one go. Let me show you how it works, how it looks first. There we go. Or not. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So what you see here now, so this is a rich text block. And all these, so this, are rich text block overflow controls. When I start dragging, you see that I'm actually creating a selection over all of them. Because it's basically one control that is stretching over several controls. It's not one control, it's one text defined in the rich text block, which is stretched over all the text block overflow controls. And this allows me to create a richer layout for text, which is otherwise very difficult and a lot of manual work to do. In this case, I just use a rich text block, and in that rich text block, I place all my text. And also in my rich text block, I specify that I want, when it's full, to go to another control. And I do that through the overflow content target, which I set to another element using a binding called overflow 1. Then we go to overflow 1. There is no text in there. Silverlight will automatically do that. When the first one is full, it says, well, then I'm going to this rich text block overflow. I put in some text, and when that one is full, I'm going to overflow number 2, and so on and so forth. Yeah? So it's basically allowing me to go chaining several overflow controls as much as I want to. If it still has text when it comes in the last one, it will show a scroll bar. Okay. The pivot viewer control, you may think, well, this is not new. Well, you're correct, it's not new. But in Silverlight 4, you had to install this thing separately. It was a separate download that you had to do. It has now become part of Silverlight 5. It's SDK. So you don't have to do a separate install. But it also works much easier. Previously, you had to do deep zoom image collections. You had to build some specific XML to define all the levels in your data for your pivot viewer. This is not needed anymore. It now works like other controls. You simply have you can simply use data binding and data templates for your different levels, making it much easier to work with. Let me show you how it works. So this is the pivot viewer. It was actually quite a lot of work to previously get started with this pivot viewer control. Like, as I mentioned, you had to create several deep zoom image collections and stuff like that. So that was actually quite annoying. Now, this is a lot easier to work with. I'm going to show it to you first, if you've never seen the Peer Viewer control. So the Peer Viewer is basically allowing you to do filtering on lots and lots of data. I don't have a lot of data because I had to type it all in myself. I have added some movies here, and I can, for example, filter my movies so that I say, well, only the films that have a duration of 90, but also include the ones that have a length of 140. So all that animation, the things flying in and out, these cards, that's actually a card that you see here, is done through that Peer Viewer control. You don't have to do anything specific for that. Now, previously, you had to do a lot of manual work to get this up and running. In Silverlight 5, it has become a lot easier. One of the things that has changed is that I can simply now data bind to it. So I create a new observable collection of movies in this case, and I set that as my item source for my Peer Viewer control. The Peer Viewer itself, as mentioned, no separate install. It is in the system Windows controls Pivo namespace, but that is included automatically with the Silverlight SDK. I then create my Pivo viewer. I set some Pivo properties, which are the properties I can filter on. In this case, it was title, duration, and director. And then I start defining a data template. In this case, I only have one data template. You can create more than one data template for the several levels if you want to, but then you need more data. So in this case, what I did here is I created a simple data template with a stack panel in there that has some text blocks, as you can see here, that are binding to title, to duration, director, and country of origin. It just works like, for example, a list box now. There's nothing new, nothing different going on in this Peer Viewer anymore. Okay. Yes? What do you mean in terms of? Yeah. I actually don't know what happens if you start editing this in Blend. That I don't know. But I assume you can do so. Yeah. But hiding things and stuff, it can actually be done through some properties. Yeah. So it can be integrated more in a full application. Yes. Okay. The two other ones that we have underneath the control section are combo box type ahead, which is something that you would have expected to be in Silverlight for quite some time already, but it was not possible. So type ahead, I just mean that when you start typing and the combo box has the focus, it will automatically jump to the correct item. Now, Silverlight 4 didn't do that, and the previous versions not either. Silverlight 5 enables you to do that. I'm going to show it to you. I don't have to show you any code because this now just works. If you had to do that in Silverlight 3 or 4, you had to use a third-party control. Now, this just works out of the box with Silverlight 4. Sorry, 5. So, let's run this thing. So, we have here a text, cover box with some values in there. And I can now start typing, and it will automatically jump to the correct item, as you can see here. It's good that it works. It just works. Don't have to show you anything for that. It's now default behavior for every combo box control. And the last thing in this section is also something that is now included, which should have been there for quite some time, which is multi-click, double-click, triple-click on a control. So previously, it wasn't possible out of the box to do double-clicking, which could be annoying. If you needed that. If you needed that, you needed to go through a timer or a thread and start checking how long the previous click had happened or when it happened. So now it is included inside of the mouse left button down event arcs. The mouse button event arcs. They actually, now that it's implemented, went all the way, and it's not just possible to do a double click, a triple click. You can go as far as you want. So you can implement a 30 double click if you want to. If you want to really annoy your customer and say, well, yes, you have to click 30 times on that thing, and then it works. A triple click might be sometimes interesting. Word, for example, also has triple click on something. So this is an ellipse. I can click on it once, I can click on it twice. And then I can keep on clicking, as you can see, and it still triggers all these click events. And so this is the 30 double click, 30 click that I've implemented here. It's very easy to do. On the mouse button event arcs, you have a click count property that you can check to see if you are doing, in fact, a double click. It just works. All right. And to finish off this talk, we're going to take a look at some miscellaneous topics that have been included, including the vector-based printing, pinvoke, and the support for multiple windows in one Silverlight application. So vector-based printing. Printing has always been not such a great story in Silverlight. In Silverlight 3, they added the writable bitmap, which could allow you to save something to a PNG, for example, and then print that afterwards. In Silverlight 4, printing was included to the print document class. However, it is not a perfect way of doing printing. If you've done any printing in Silverlight, you probably have noticed that when you go over 2-3 pages, it starts slowing down a lot. Not Silverlight, although Silverlight starts using a lot of memory, but when you start sending a report of 50-60 pages to your printer, it's going to be like maybe 2-3 gigabytes of data that goes to your printer, bringing down your entire network, which can be fun if you don't feel like working that day, but anyway. So printing in Silverlight 4 is just... The reason that it's actually doing that, it's creating bitmaps, and it's sending those bitmaps to the printer, causing a lot of data. Now, in Silverlight 5, they have added an option to do PostScript printing, which is basically a lot lighter in the format that goes over the line. It still uses the same classes and the same event, so the print document with the print page, the print begin print, and end print. All those things still work in the same way. What they actually did is they made PostScripting the default, but you, of course, need a PostScript printer to be installed on your system. So if you don't have that, then it will still default to the regular bitmap printing. It also has now a printer fallback settings class. And the printer fallback settings, you can create an instance of that thing and pass it some parameters that influence how the printing will actually be done. There's two options on that, the force factor and the opacity threshold. Now, I'm not an expert on these things, but basically, PostScript printing doesn't support the printing of things that don't have an opacity that is set to 1. You can, however, influence this. If you use the force factor, set it to true, and then set the opacity threshold to, for example, 0.5, that will result in everything between 0.5 and 1 for the opacity value to be printed with an opacity of 1, so plainly visible. Otherwise, if Silverlight encounters an element that has an opacity that is not 1, it will automatically fall back also on printing the bitmap itself. I didn't bring my printer. So we're actually going to take a look at the code, and you'll see that it's very very much similar to what we had before. So let's take a look at... Come on. There we go. So in this case, I'm forcing the print via vector. So basically, I'm saying you need to go through vector printing. So what I'm doing here is I'm... So automatically, it will check if I have a PostScript printer installed. If I don't have it installed, it will still go to bitmap-based printing. But here I'm printing, I want to print something that has an opacity that is somewhere not compatible with PostScript printing. So I say the opacity threshold should be 0.5 and force factor is true. So everything that has an opacity between 0.5 and 1 will then be printed as an opacity of 1. Regular printing, exactly the same, still a print document. If you still want to default to bitmap printing, there is something new for that, which is the print bitmap will automatically cause to be printing to a bitmap. Okay. There's now also support for pinvoke calls. So it is possible from Silverlight 5 applications to do a call to a native component. It was possible in Silverlight 4 to do a call to a COM component. In Silverlight 5, it has become possible to call a native Win32 C++ component. It works in the exact same way as it does in regular .NET, so it works through a DLL import, as you can see here. There are some uses of that. I'm going to show you a couple of things. Pinvokes. All right. Let's run it first. I'm going to put on some sound. Okay. So it is possible, for example, to call on the beep function, which is natively in Windows, to create random beeps. There we go. Again, if you want to annoy your user, that's perfectly possible to do so. You can call the Windows sounds. Don't know if you can hear it, but I'm sure you can imagine something with it. You can call the run dialog, the open, with some parameters, as you can see here. It's opened with pinvoke from Silverlight, so I put up the text there, some default values, that's possible. And you can also call on the creation of a directory on the drive, on the C drive in this case. That's possible to do from Silverlight as well, and that directory should be there. There it is. It all works in the exact same way, and it's basically the same code as in full.NET. So you do a DLL import, as you see here. And in this case, I'm using that beep function, passing in a frequency and a duration. And then when I click on that beep button, I'm calling onto that beep function, passing in two integer values, a random and a duration of 100 milliseconds. It works, it works with each and every native component that you have on your system. Of course, the application has to run as an application with elevated trust. It works in browser and out of browser in the same way. And we have 2 minutes left for the last demo, so we should be there in time. And that is multiple windows. It is now possible in Silverlight to do more than one window. So in Silverlight 4, we already had a child window, a notification window, if you're running out of browser. So the notification window like Outlook had, a small toast window. In Silverlight 5, it is possible to create a real native window next to the Silverlight window that is running. They can communicate with each other. When you close the Silverlight application, everything is going to be closed. It is not possible to respawn, let's say, the Silverlight application from a child window. You cannot call it back. When it's closed, everything is gone. So Silverlight will always be the main window. The other windows can only be a child window. I wanted to say something else, but I can't remember. Okay, let's take a look at this in the last demo. You can't create model windows. That's what I wanted to say. So it is always modeless. So you cannot make one of those child windows blocking the UI. You can create them with a standard Chrome, and you can create them with your own Chrome if you want to. And let's run it. So in this case, I'm going to open a regular window. I can open as many as I want. And I can also create one without Chrome and then add my own Chrome, as you can see here. When I create my main, when I close my main window, all the child windows get closed as well. Let's take a look at how this was done from code. There we go. So I click on that button to create a new instance. And I say, well, create me a new window, give it a width, give it a height, then set the content to a pop-up window, which is in this case a user control. That's the thing with all that XAML in there and with the little girl in the plane. This one. And then I set the visibility to visible, and it will be shown automatically. Okay? So that is actually the last thing that I had to tell you. And we're just out of time, so it seems to be good. So I hope I've given you a nice overview of the features that that makes Silverlight 5 an even better platform for building enterprise applications. They added a lot in the data binding area. They added features in the application model. And they also fixed quite a lot of things that annoyed the line of business developer, like not being able to call onto or do a multiple click and select something in the combo box. I hope this was interesting for you. If you have any questions, please come up to me. We'll do them offline. So I hope you have a nice last day of Tech Days. Thanks for coming, and see you later. Bye-bye.